Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
While the Indian Air Force squadrons continued to fly in very marginal conditions because they were so determined not to give anyone an excuse to say you haven't measured up. And there were a couple of cases when they were threatened, when a squadron commander turned down a request to fly in marginal conditions and things like that. And he was threatened by his liaison officer with a charge of cowardice and so on. So there were incidents like that. A couple of other historians have used this phrase. They've said the Indian Air Force was an experiment that was not meant to succeed.
Welcome to Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Sri, welcome back to Extended.
Thank you for having me again, Peter, and thank you for your patience.
It's great to have you back. I really enjoyed the first part of this series. We talked about the growth in pilots and some coming through the system, but I wanted to focus more about their training now, their tactics, and some of the incidents that we saw in India and Burma. So let's talk first about their training. How did they come from a standing start to being hurry bomber pilots and Lysander pilots and so forth?
It was actually pretty much a standing start, Peter, because as I've mentioned in my book, at the outbreak of the war in 1939, the Indian Air Force was still just one squadron, plus the few coast defense flights. And that really represented no growth at all, or very little growth at all, over the 7 years since the Indian Air Force had been established. But by 1941, they'd grown to three squadrons. And in 1943, they grew to seven. And the following year, they grew to nine. So they really took off from there quite rapidly, particularly given what a low industrial and training base they were starting from. So how they did it, as mentioned, the first 20-odd officers of the Indian Air Force over a period of 7 years were trained at Cranwell. But that was clearly not an option when you start growing by more than a couple of orders of magnitude. So initially, the first pure Indian Air Force batch of pilot training was actually conducted in Egypt. That was a relatively small batch, about a dozen officers. But it had to be done in Egypt, where there was a fair amount of training being conducted for the Allies in the period 1939-40. From then onwards, training started in India, and there was a lot of work put into setting up training schools in a similar pattern to the Royal Air Force. There were a couple of elementary flying training schools, and flying clubs in India were also roped into that elementary flying stage training. Then there was what they called advanced flying, which today would probably be called stage two. The elementary flying was on Tiger Moths, Percival Proctors, aircraft like that. Stage two or the advanced flying was on Harvards generally. And then there was operational training. And we had pretty much the same names. We had we had EFTSs, we had advanced flying schools, and we had operational training units. And by about 1943, we'd separated operational training units for fighters and for bombers, for dive bombers mostly, at that time. The numbers grew very, very fast. But the instructors, I think it has to be said, the instructors in many cases were not necessarily people who'd gone through a flying instructor's school. In many cases, the instructors were operational pilots who were back on a break between operational tours, and training was considered an adequate sort of rest for them. And they're on record, some of them, as saying, you know, they didn't really enjoy training. They felt it was, you know, an uphill slog training Indians, and they wanted to get back into operations. And so there is a there were definitely some instructors there who weren't entirely dedicated to the training task.
Sri, did these instructors come from India, from the Indian Air Force, or did they come from the RAF?
No, the first batch were almost entirely RAF or Dominion personnel. There were people who came to India from, you know, there were Canadians, Australians, New Zealanders, South Africans, Rhodesians. All of those were represented among the air crew who came out to India with varying degrees of, you know, enthusiasm and otherwise. Many of the Dominion aircrew actually wanted to fly in Europe, and they saw India as a bit of a backwater. But you know, somehow or other, it eventually all came together. And I think it's also fair to say, while I make these implicit criticisms of the you know, unpreparedness of the instructors and so on, I think it's fair to say that all allied countries were facing similar constraints. I mean, nobody had hundreds of instructor qualified QFIs, you know, ready to go and start training young men. So everyone was making, you know, a fist of it. And in India, it, you know, it did result in training a great many people. But again, as I set out in my book, attrition was very, very high. I mean, the dropout rates were as high as 60% in the elementary flying stage. And in 1943, I think the you know, the senior officers got round to appointing, setting up an inquiry into why the dropout rate was so high. And I've read excerpts of that report. And it pretty much blames the students. It says that they didn't have the right, they didn't have eye-hand coordination, they didn't have, you know, a mechanical mindset and various other things like that. So so there it was.
Sri, was that down to the quality of the students and the selection process, or was that one of those rather unfortunate styles that came from the RAF culture in terms of their assessment of pilots from India?
Again, to be fair to both sides, Peter, I think there were elements of both. I think we tend not to fully appreciate the extent to which, in an environment like the UK in 1941 and 1942, nearly all the young men who were applying for flying training had some idea of what it represented. I think it's fair to say that in India, you know, at the Cranwell at the stage when all flying training was being done at Cranwell, or the coast defense flights were being set up. Again, you know, the coast defense flights were set up mainly from people who were already qualified, you know, private pilots or civil pilots. And in most cases, they were known to the RAF officers who were doing the selection and training. So they came from a very similar, you know, demographic. They spoke English beautifully. They were already used to working with Europeans. So that worked very, very well. When the big expansion started, quite naturally, you had to start pulling in from a much wider demographic. And I think it's probably fair to say that not all the young Indians who came in knew what to expect. Having said that, it's also fairly clear, in my mind, it's fairly clear that the that not all instructors were, you know, good, gifted teachers or even capable, competent teachers. And there were cultural, there definitely were cultural gaps. I mean, there's no point in, you know, I, without being woke or the opposite, I think there is no point, there were gaps, there were cultural gaps, there were communication gaps. And, you know, looking back 80 years later, maybe we can find it in ourselves to sympathize a little with both sides. It was a difficult task. And but at the end of the day, we, you know, the Indian Air Force ended the war with over 1,000 qualified aircrew from almost a standing start. So that's got to mean something.
Wow. So we talked about the expansion in the squadrons, and you mentioned some of the squadron growth there. As these pilots started to migrate into operational environments, let's start to talk about some of the operations they were involved in. I mentioned in the first part of this talking about the Hurry Bomber.
Yes.
I've got to be honest, I didn't know much about it. Can you take us through some of that, some of the operations they were involved in and some of the aircraft that they were using?
Sure, love to. So I think fair to say that the Hurricane was the single most important aircraft type operated by the Indian Air Force during World War II. Of the 9 squadrons that were operational during World War II, 8 of them flew Hurricanes at some point or other in their operational lives. Now, the Hurricanes they flew were mainly the Mark 2Bs and 2Cs, which were, a bit different from the Hurricanes that flew over Europe. They had an operated engine. Some of them had 12 machine guns instead of the 8. The 2Bs had 12 machine guns instead of the 8 machine guns of the Mark 1s. And the 2Cs had 4 cannons. 420mm cannon, which packed quite a punch, but they carried only about a tenth as many shells as the machine guns did because of the weight restrictions and so on. The cannon shells weighed about cannon ammunition weighed about 10 times as much round for round as machine gun ammunition did. So there were constraints of that nature. And then another way in which the Hurricanes differed from those in Europe was most of them had this dust filter under the nose, under the chin of the aircraft. So that gave it a slightly different profile and appearance. Another thing to say is that most of the Hurricanes that came to the Indian Air Force were not new. They'd been operated mainly in the Middle East, because the aircraft that came already fitted with those dust filters were mainly aircraft that came from the Middle East, and they'd really been flogged in the Middle East quite a bit. But the Indian Air Force was, as I hinted last time, the Indian Air Force was delighted to be getting Hurricanes, to be getting all-metal monoplane aircraft. And they really put their, the technical, the airmen really put their heart and soul into maintaining and polishing the aircraft, and they really worked very, very hard to make both serviceability and even appearance something exemplary. And this paid off. I mean, they had, many of the Indian Air Force units showed pretty impressive levels of serviceability. And there are stories about how they concealed some small accidents from higher authorities and worked overnight to fix them. So the accident and the repair never actually went on the books because they were so keen to keep their serviceability levels high and their accident and incident rates low. Having said that, they were second-hand aircraft. It was a difficult environment in many ways. They were flying off. In the early years, they were flying off semi-prepared fields often. So they had all those challenges to deal with as well. And all of that fed into, their ability to run operations.
And just talking about the types of Hurricanes you mentioned there and the type of armament, just explain to us why that was the case, because it was the role they were undertaking. There's a very strong perception in most people's minds about the role of the Hurricane, and it was very much air-to-air. But actually, that's very, very different in this theatre, wasn't it? There's not an air-to-air, not in the whole, an air-to-air
Absolutely.
Combat.
The Indian Air Force and indeed all the Allied Air Forces in the Burma-India theatre were operating much more as a tactical air force supporting the ground forces than as a aerial dogfight aerial dogfighting arm. So most of their flying was done at low levels. There was nothing like the Hurricanes and Spitfires that flew in the Battle of Britain were mostly doing their flying at medium to high altitudes, intercepting German bombers and being controlled by very elaborate, what we'd now call air defense ground environment systems. There was a bit of an air defense ground environment system that was attempted to be set up in the India-Burma theater, and it did have its value. But the distances were just so much greater. The concentration of aircraft was much sparser on both sides, and the radar coverage simply wasn't there. So most of the work was done at low level, supporting the troops. And this actually had an interesting couple of spin-offs in the at the advanced training stage. At the advanced training stage, there was a lot of emphasis made on low-level flying and support on recognizing ground forces, recognizing armor, and being able to support our own ground forces. And a lot of the young men of the Indian Air Force who'd grown up, you know, reading a lot of the same accounts as the other Allied pilots, they also all wanted to go into go and fight Japanese air forces one on one, and there are some accounts in the stories I've picked up from veterans. Senior veterans came to them and sort of counseled them and explained to them that the impact on a battle was actually a lot higher if you looked at the ability to deliver ordnance on the enemy at designated points on demand. That actually had a much greater impact on a battle than fighting one-on-one in the air between aircraft of roughly equal performance. So there was a lot of that kind of counseling and advice that was done. And a final component of, you know, addition to that, to learning how to fight in this environment, was the this little-known unit called the Air Fighting Training Unit, the AFTU. This was an establishment that was set up in India by the great Frank Carey, who was a wing commander and a group captain at that time. He'd spent the first year of the war as a sergeant pilot, I think, flew in the Battle of Britain with great distinction, got himself a DFM at that time, and then proceeded to get a string of the of other decorations after he'd been commissioned. Flew in the Middle East, I think, one other theater besides Europe, before coming out to India. When he came out to India, briefly, he commanded a hurricane squadron. But then somebody had the bright idea that it would make much more sense to put him in charge of this training unit that did the training that was required to change, to inculcate new pilots with this with the kind of flying that was more appropriate in the India-Burma environment, and in the case of people who were coming in for a second tour after a tour in Europe, to change their habits, because that was necessary too. People who'd done well in Europe still needed to be retrained a bit to be most effective in the India-Burma theater. And some of that is the same as the Americans found out with dogfighting Japanese. You don't dogfight. You dive on them. Preferably, you dive on them from above, single pass, slashing attack, and then dive out of the way. So that was the tactic. Yeah. Those are the kind of tactics that the Air Fighting Training Unit taught for air combat, and a whole different set of tactics for low level support. Because so much of the flying was done at low level, the dive and dive away tactic wasn't always possible, but it was the best way to fight Japanese fighters, which were generally more maneuverable than the Allied fighters. Yeah.
I broke off the attack, at the same time warning my number two. I gave the attacking Oscar a burst, but on looking around, found two other Oscars diving on me. I skidded, slipped, and went as low as I possibly could and steered north, but they followed me on and on without giving me a chance to cross the hills on the left to get home. I'd now been chased for 5 minutes. During the chase, I was pulling up, skidding, and doing steep turns to avoid the Oscars, but they kept pursuing me relentlessly. Finally, I flew straight and throttled back completely. Both Oscars, coming on at great speed, overshot me, and one came right within my gun sight at about 20 yards. I gave a long burst and noticed direct hits on the wings and fuselage. The Oscars rolled away. But I had no time to see any more of him since the other Oscar was turning in for me. The chase carried on for another 10 minutes. He made it home, but his wingman, P.O. Battatree, was shot down.
Did you know that in the late 1940s, during atomic weapons testing in the Pacific, the USA used Boeing B-17 flying fortresses as unmanned radio-controlled drones? Did you also know that in 1927, two RAF officers in a Hawker Horsley set a new distance record, flying from Britain to the Persian Gulf, only for it to be eclipsed just hours later by Charles Lindbergh's Solo Atlantic crossing, which was a mere 180 miles longer? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
In the book, Sri, you have some, for want of a better description, some real boys' own stuff in terms of some of the accounts. They're not stories, they're accounts. Yes. Of some of these incidents. They're really, really amazing. Do you want to maybe give us a flavour for one or two of those attacks and those stories that you do have in the book?
Sure. I mean, we talked a lot about hurricanes. The other, monoplane, first of the all-metal monoplane types that the Indian Air Force flew was the Vulti Vengeance dive bomber, which they enjoyed. They really enjoyed flying it because it was a robust, reliable kind of aircraft. I've had some wonderful exchanges on Twitter with an Australian military historian called Ernest Malley, whom you might know, and he and I have had a wonderful time talking up the Vulti Vengeance and poking fun at the Air Ministry officials who thought it wasn't, a suitable aircraft for the European theater. But anyway, the Vulti Vengeance was a dive bomber. It dived vertically at 90 degrees, which is steeper than the Stuka did, and it had some aerodynamic fittings and flap, which actually assisted that. So those features were put into good use by two Indian Air Force squadrons which operated the Vulti Vengeance, as well as a couple of Royal Australian Air Force squadrons and a couple of RAF squadrons in the theater. That vertical diving actually made for some differences in tactics. When the rains began in this theater, the cloud base was actually too low to do that kind of diving attack. So they had to switch to shallow diving. And they seemed to really enjoy it. I mean, there was very little in the first year that they did that kind of flying. There wasn't much Japanese fighter opposition. So they saw this and there was plenty of Japanese anti-aircraft fire, but there was very little Japanese fighter opposition. So they really kind of enjoyed it. And they'd fly out sometimes with Hurricane escort, and the Vengeances were pretty powerful. So after dropping their bombs, they could actually fly pretty nearly faster than the Hurricanes. And they'd call insulting things to the Hurricane escort and say, "Would you like us to slow down a little?" And phrases to that effect.
Excellent stuff. But we've talked about multi-allied involvement, but the RAF dominated the theatre and the growth of the Indian Air Force. And I think it's fair to say, Sri, that it wasn't always totally fair. And I was quite interested to see the reports about Flight Lieutenant Sparks and First Flight Officer Krishna. Do you want to just give us a flavour for that, of some of the inadequacies in the way that everybody was treated pretty much unequally?
The incident you're referring to came about in late 1944, by which time, I think, in military terms, the Allies were on the ascendant. But there was a lot of nervousness among the British in India, particularly, partly because, as you might be aware, in 1942, the Congress Party, which was the largest political party in India, and which 5 years earlier, 1937, there had actually been elections with a partial Indian electorate. And And about five cities in India had Congress Party mayors, and there was some Congress Party legislators in the Legislative Assembly and so on. But in 1942, they'd actually gone on a Mahatma Gandhi, whom I admire in many ways, but I think was wrong on this particular point. Mahatma Gandhi had called for a sort of a total opposition to the British in 1942, and that was obviously a bad year for the British. So the authorities had responded by arresting all the entirety of the Congress leadership, and they put them in jail for about a year and a half. And in 1944, a lot of them had just been released, and there was a lot of nervousness among the British authorities about how they would respond and how they'd influence the Indian public. And that was compounded by the fact that that was the year that the Indian National Army, the force that was started by Subhash Chandra Bose, a former congressman who'd who basically started to oppose the British militarily on the basis that my enemy's enemy is my friend. And there was, I think, you know, this is actually something that becomes very, very controversial in India, because for various political reasons, Subhash Chandra Bose's contribution has gone through periods of being ignored and being appreciated. And right now, he's, the current government has been talking up his contributions. But I think it's fair to say the Indian National Army at its peak was only about 40,000 men. And the number of Indians who signed up for the Indian Army fighting the Axis was something like 2.5 million. So there's really no numeric comparison. But where there is a comparison is those 40,000 INA really frightened the British. And the British had visions of 1857 levels of violence, of the Indian mutiny levels of violence. So they became very, very sensitive to anything that looked like sedition. And they had very, very strong sedition laws, which some of which were misused during that period. And many young Indian officers, and in the case that you mentioned, one British officer who was suspect because he was in a personal relationship with an Indian woman, and quite a high profile relationship, because that Indian woman was actually a film actress, predecessor to Bollywood. So those officers were arrested in a couple of cases simply for asking for maps which didn't pertain directly to the areas they were operating in. And that was treated as evidence of suspicion. They were arrested straight out of the cockpit in some cases while on operations, hauled back to India, subject to some brief trial, and then dismissed from service in most cases. And these young men were all volunteers. They'd all volunteered for the services. They'd volunteered to fly at a time when that was a very risky business. So it really was heartbreaking for many of them personally. And again, I think no one would have batted an eyelid at a British officer who was engaged in a relationship with a woman in India of European origin, even if she'd been in India for many years and things like that. No one would have batted an eyelid if a British officer had asked for a wider range of maps on the basis that he wanted to know a little more about the context. So there was definitely, a lot of unfairness about yeah. that. In the circumstances yeah. of the time, I don't know that you can be too judgmental. I know that I know where my sympathies lie, but I don't know yeah. how strongly.
Yeah, it's hard to look back, isn't it, and use the same judgment that we have today in those yes. circumstances. It doesn't excuse it, though. But I wanted to just really bring that example to play, because there you had a British officer, and as you said, was flying there and literally dragged from the cockpit and arrested. So very sad times. But yeah. I want to bring us back to aeroplanes, because
as a little bit of trivia, I actually exchanged a few emails with Flying Officer Sparks, the British officer.
Okay.
He was still alive when I started researching these things. So I managed to exchange a few emails with him. And he had a pretty robust way of expressing himself, but he came across on email. I never met him. Came across as a wonderfully outspoken sort of person. So anyway.
Yeah, and a great role model for making the changes we need in the world.
Flight Lieutenant Shivdev Singh, one of the flight commanders, and Flying Officer Verma were on a ground attack sortie when Flight Lieutenant Shivdev Singh's aircraft was damaged by Japanese anti-aircraft fire. Flight Lieutenant Shivdev Singh nursed the aircraft to an emergency landing strip nearby and put it down safely, only to find that fighting at almost hand-to-hand quarters was swirling around the strip and Japanese troops already held one end. Flying Officer Verma strafed the Japanese and helped the Allied troops on the ground to silence them, but it was not certain how long the strip would remain clear. He returned to base, where, alerted by radio, the CO, Squadron Leader Mehar Singh, was waiting for him in the cockpit of their North American T-6 Harford HAC aircraft. Verma climbed into the second seat of the Harford, and he and Squadron Leader Mehar Singh took off, escorted by four of the squadron's Hurricanes. With Flying Officer Verma as his guide, Squadron Leader Mehar Singh found the emergency strip and landed at Harvard alongside Flight Lieutenant Shivdev Singh's damaged Hurricane. Having determined there was no way to carry out long-term repairs to the Hurricane where it was, quick temporary fixes were effected, including to a huge hole in the leading edge of the port wing, by stuffing it with gunny, jute sacks and bedsheets, while the escort Hurricanes continued circling protectively overhead. Squadron Leader Mehar Singh then sent Flight Lieutenant Shivdev Singh and Flying Officer Verma back in the Harvard and flew the Hurricane himself, temporarily patched up, out of the emergency strip and back to base, still covered by the four escorting Hurricanes.
But I'm going to drag you back to aeroplanes again, I'm afraid, Sri. So let's go back to talking about, the hurried bombers are well engaged and predominant in and dominant in ground attack operations in support of the pushback as the Allied forces started pushing the Japanese back and winning that. Before we go on to talk about Mosquitoes and Spitfires or not, I just wanted to ask a quick question. We mentioned the monsoons in part one. One of the key things that I picked up through the book is that many of these pilots flew in those conditions, didn't they?
They did. It was very difficult flying. I mean, there were low cloud base. There were, there was a very violent. There was a lot of cumulonimbus, which meant violent sort of air currents. Strong enough to tear an aircraft apart inside the clouds, and these cloud banks stretched for miles, so you couldn't go around them. I mean, they were just too big to go around. But it was actually a Mountbatten directive to continue flying through the monsoons. And, the Allied Air Forces sort of responded and they continued to fly. But all the Allied Air Forces, and I think particularly the Indian Air Force, certainly lost, more aircraft to weather during the monsoon months than they did to enemy action. And I said particularly the Indian Air Force. And again, if I can sort of... this is something that I can't justify on a statistical basis because I don't have access to all the Allied squadrons' records, but the Indian Air Force was very, very reluctant to refuse a request because of weather, because they were just so they were burning all the time to prove themselves, right? Whereas Allied squadrons, in many cases, it's the White Cliffs of Dover syndrome. They weren't flying in defense of the White Cliffs of Dover. So in many cases, I think they were more prepared than the IAF squadrons were to say, no, we can't fly in this weather. Tell a group that we're standing down. While the Indian Air Force squadrons, I think, continued to fly in very marginal conditions because they were so determined not to give anyone an excuse to say, you haven't measured up. And there were a couple of cases when they were threatened on those lines, when when a squadron commander turned down a request to fly in marginal conditions on the basis that his squadron had already done two sorties, that squadron strength sorties that day, and the light levels were now too low for safe flying and things like that. And he was threatened by his liaison officer with a charge of cowardice and And so on. So there were incidents like that. There's also, I mean, I read in one squadron ORB a very, very poignant account of a young Hurricane pilot who'd gone out, who'd been sent out to fly. He'd just been with the squadron a very brief time, a couple of weeks or so. He got lost and he couldn't find his way back. But he could, he was able to talk to them on the radio, which was actually unusual because radio, the VHF radios very often didn't work in bad weather. But so he, for 20 minutes, he was actually talking to his base and appealing for, you know, some way to get back until he ran out of fuel and, you know, just was lost. So there are some really poignant stories around that exercise of being
very sad.
Of flying through the monsoon. But
okay, well, I mentioned the Mosquito there. We eventually saw the Spitfire introduced to theatre. Did the Mosquitoes make it or not?
Not into the Indian Air Force, no. I mean, there were some RAF squadrons and some other allied squadrons which flew Mosquitoes in the theatre. But they had several unexplained crashes which were eventually traced to the delamination of the laminated wood that went into the Mosquito airframe and tropical conditions. And I've also heard it said that they, some of them were attacked by insects in tropical insects, which ate away at the wood. I haven't seen that in official documents. So the official documents talk a lot about the delamination of the wood that went into those. So Mosquitoes never, so the Indian Air Force never got to operate the Mosquitoes. I mentioned to you that the Indian Air Force operated Vengeances at the same time that they first got Hurricanes. Two squadrons operated Vengeances, and the Vengeances are flown by two-man crews, like the Mosquito. So when the Vengeances were withdrawn, there was a plan to replace them with Mosquitoes, which would have enabled the two-man crews to continue. And the Vengeance squadrons had done very well with the two-man crews, and they'd demonstrated a lot of, a sort of solidarity between the pilots and the rear seatmen. And they were looking forward to continuing that with the Mosquito. And when the word came through that they weren't going to get Mosquitoes, of the two Vengeance squadrons, one was told to convert to Hurricanes and one to Spitfires. Now, they were really torn, I think, particularly the squadron that went to Spitfires, because even at that stage of the war, late 1944, early 1945, the Spitfire had a magic. And all these young men were delighted to be getting Spitfires. But there was a genuine feeling of loss at having to break up the two-man crews and send the observers and gunners to non-flying roles. And that comes through in the ORBs. They've actually written about how sorry they were to break up those roles. And a lot of the people who wore observer or gunner half-wing badges, they didn't get to fly again during the war. Once the Vengeances were withdrawn, a lot of them went into ground roles. So there was a lot
of... Oh, that's sad. What was the role of the Spitfire? Was it similar to the Hurricane?
Yes, it actually was. It wasn't being used as an interceptor at that stage of the war. It was being used for ground attack and reconnaissance. Reconnaissance was a very important part of the Indian Air Force's role. I miss saying that when we talked about the AFTU. And the senior pilots who did the counseling, they also made a point of saying that, the value of bringing back information. This theater of war was being fought over terrain that was completely unmapped. And there were very few maps. There were very few of the electronic aids that we take for granted nowadays. So the Indian Air Force was actually flying ahead of ground troops, photographing the terrain that they were advancing into, flying back, having the photographs developed literally overnight in the squadron, and then sometimes dropping those photographs to the forward troops to give them an idea of what they were advancing into.
Wow.
So the photographic reconnaissance and tactical reconnaissance work that the Air Force did was also very, very useful. And Spitfires did well in that role, in the reconnaissance roles. And they were very stable. They were good platforms for that role as well. Fast
I think one of the things that I really took away from reading the story about the Indian Air Force was how successful it was in ground liaison with the Army. You know, that we've talked about the hurry bombers and the ground attack role. That only worked when you had really, really good liaison between the ground and the air. That was one of the key messages I certainly took from the book.
No, I think that is one of their accomplishments, definitely. The squadron ORBs, the Indian Air Force squadron ORBs, and I've read through all of them, actually. They're full of sort of signals from the army formations that they've been supporting. And they all had every squadron had a GLO or ALO, ground liaison officer or army liaison officer, of generally of the rank of at least captain, if not major. And if he was a major, he was of the same rank as the squadron CO. So they all had ALOs and GLOs, and the ALOs and GLOs actually did a lot to cement the cooperation between the air and the ground elements of the forces. And, they'd often have when the pilots came back and landed, they'd sometimes have the signals from the forward, from the commanding officers of the forward troops. They'd have those signals printed and sort of up on the notice board for the for all the pilots to see as they came in. So they played a role in keeping that coordination going. And the Indian Air Force has continued to do that both ways. They normally post a young liaison officer with the ground troops. I mean, many of the ground attack task squadrons have a young Air Force officer posted with the forward elements of the ground troops. And they've generally done pretty well, including after independence. Those officers have done those. It's not a very popular role among the Air Force officers. Again, the ORBs are full of stories of how those Air Force liaison officers posted with the ground troops sent plaintive messages back requesting to be rescued from the army and so on. But they did well. So all the evidence is that they did well.
So could you just come into the end of our discussion? I could go on for a long time. There's so many great anecdotes in there. But let's look back at how would you sum up the role of Indians and the Indian Air Force in the contribution to World War II?
Well, if I can sort of go back a few years to the early 30s, when the Indian Air Force was just being thought of, and General Skeen had to some horror in British circles had recommended the establishment of an independent Indian Air Force. I think a couple of other historians have used this phrase. They've said the Indian Air Force was an experiment that was not meant to succeed. They actually allowed the Indian Air Force to be formed, thinking that they'd be so incompetent. And in the first couple of years, they had some bad crashes, and three out of the first five Cranwell graduates were out of the Air Force within three. Well, two of them were killed, and one was dismissed for an accident. So the first couple of years, it was not at all sure that the experiment of establishing an Indian Air Force would succeed. But the summary at the end of the war, I would say that, I think the ground forces contribution by Indian troops, no one except the most, sort of historically ignorant can say that the Indian ground forces weren't a significant part of the Allied forces, particularly in these theaters. The Indian Air Force, I would say, was a small part of the Allied of the combined Allied force, but it was an extremely important part, and it has been hugely important to India because it has made a big difference to India's post-independence military development.
Okay, thank you very much, Sri, for joining us. I just want to mention, I'd be calling you Sri all the time, but you're published under the name K.S. Nair. So I do apologise to listeners if they were a little confused. Of course, the discussion's based on the book, The Forgotten Few, The Indian Air Force in World War II, and that's published by HarperCollins. And we'd just like to say thank you to HarperCollins because they gave us permission to quote some of the excerpts you're going to hear from the book. So we're very grateful for that permission. Sri, just a reminder, where can we find you online?
at the Brown Beagle on Twitter.
And what's the next piece of work you're on to now? What are you doing now?
You know, I have about three projects that I'm working on. I don't have a contract for any of them yet with any of the publishers, but I will chase them for that. So I have about three projects. One of which is, again, it's a campaign. It's a kind of a campaign history, but the one that I'm sort of a little nervous about, but excited about too, is I've been wondering if I could possibly write a historical fiction book about Indians in the Second World War.
Okay.
And I'm thinking of that only because I kind of suspect that, you know, my books about the Indian Air Force have been greeted with, you know, gratifying appreciation by people like yourself and other enthusiasts. But they are read primarily by enthusiasts, by people who are already interested in the topic. And I just think that if an effective fiction book might actually spread the story a little more widely. I haven't quite made up my mind yet. I have a former editor who's very encouraging and sort of urging me to do it.
So, right. Okay.
We'll see.
Okay.
Well,
we'll look out for that. But listen, thanks so much for joining us. We've really enjoyed getting this insight into the Indian Air Force, but more importantly, to those Indians who contributed to the Allied forces in World War II.
Peter, thank you. Thank you to Aviation Extended, and thank you to all your backers and supporters for giving me this platform. As you said, I could go on, and I'm very grateful that you gave me this opportunity.
Well, I'm convinced this isn't the last time we've heard from you. I think there's maybe a little bit more we can dig into, but that's for another time. So that's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts as well as the wider extended family of supporters, including Mick Oakey at The Aviation Historian. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find Tim Garofanelli on the extended Twitter, Facebook and Instagram feeds. And I just want to say that you've heard Gareth contributing to those excerpts from the book, and we're very appreciative for him doing that. That's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Shree.
Goodbye, everybody, and thank you for listening.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Extend it!
This is XTP Media.